From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you so much for doing that. It helps us immensely. You are putting this show on the air. Now, if you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep the show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, please let me take a moment here to point out that the opinions expressed on our program do not necessarily reflect the views of the staff or management of this radio station or of Interfaith Alliance. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, LGBTQI people of faith and their allies are mourning the loss of the Reverend Elder Freda Smith, who passed away this week at the age of 84. Elder Smith was the first woman ordained in the Metropolitan Community Church, a non-denominational global ministry. In 1975, she co-performed the first U.S. same-sex wedding with a government-issued civil marriage license in Denver. Her ministry continued until recent days. In 2019, a judge in Texas has been refusing to perform same-sex weddings because, in her words, quote, "I have no desire to offend anybody, but the last person I want to offend is God." So far, Diana Hensley has gotten off with just a warning. People of goodwill around the globe continue to struggle with finding ways to challenge the torrent of anti-Semitism that is engulfing the globe. This week, 107 headstones in a historic Jewish cemetery in France were defaced with swastikas. It's the third such attack this year in that country. Closer to home, in Washington, D.C., the historic 6th and I Synagogue was similarly defaced on November 29th. Meanwhile, a report in The Forward challenges the current narrative of growing anti-Semitic sentiment on North American college campuses. Researchers at Stanford and Brandeis Universities separately concluded that Jewish students they surveyed are feeling, quote, comfortable on their campuses as Jews, and, quote, they do not think their campus is hostile to Jews. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
That's what they do to gain access into the country. They lodge claims on asylum, and they're totally bogus claims.
They're all met by the lawyers, and they say the following phrase, "I am very afraid for my life. I am afraid for my life." Okay.
For most Americans, Thanksgiving marked the start of a holiday season centered around home and family. At the same time, tens of millions of people around the globe have lost or fled their homes in recent years, are languishing in refugee camps, and some have been forcibly separated from other family members by our own government. On this week's show, we'll get the perspective of Rabbi Justin David of HIAS, a nonprofit organization that's been helping refugees and displaced persons as mandated by Jewish teachings for 130 years.
We cannot continue to keep rejecting the poor, rejecting the hurting, and only talking about the middle class and the wealthy. That is only a way for this country to be disempowered. And this is bigger than the next election. This is about whether America can be America itself.
Across the country, people of faith have been rallying around a call for compassion, inclusivity, and fairness in the face of what many see as a repudiation of those values by many of our current political leaders. Leaders such as the Reverend William Barber in North Carolina have taken the lead, but a compelling new book argues that it is the participation of so many diverse Americans that gives the most hope at a time such as this. The book is titled Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good, and you'll meet its author, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, on this week's State of Belief. But first,
if a student wants to turn in a paper that goes against fact, against anything that we know to be true in science, and they base it on their religion, then that student can't be penalized for that incorrect answer.
For example, if the assignment is, how old is the world? The assignment now has to be, how old is the world under evolutionary theory, as opposed to creationism theory?
The past few weeks have seen provocative headlines in secular news outlets. Here's a typical one. New Ohio law lets students give wrong answers on tests for religious reasons. Now, at issue is the Ohio Student Religious Liberties Act, and it's important to separate the fact from hyperbole around this kind of legislation. So to do that, I am happy to be joined by Gary Daniels, Chief Lobbyist at the ACLU of Ohio. Gary, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
Out of several causes for concern in this legislation, the part that has received national coverage is this idea that students must be allowed to provide wrong answers to questions if those answers reflect the student's religious beliefs. Is that actually true?
Well, I'm happy that you framed it as fact versus hyperbole because, as is the case with a lot of legislation, nuance matters and the exact language of a bill matters. So I think it's too strong to say absolutely that this would allow students to give wrong answers that are religious-based with regard to their assignments and coursework and what have you. But with House Bill 164 here in Ohio, what the language basically says is it talks about, you know, the way that you are supposed to grade these assignments are using, quote, ordinary academic standards of substance and relevance, including any legitimate pedagogical concerns. And if the bill stopped there, basically what it would be doing is restating how teachers already do this with regard to coursework. But then the bill goes on to say, in this very same section following immediately after, and shall not penalize or reward a student based on the religious content of a student's work. And the problem here is that can be read any number of different ways and is open to interpretation. Now, I know some proponents of this bill have been basically saying, look, the concerns are overblown here. What we're trying to prevent is where a student is, you know, engaging in artwork or a term paper or an essay or what have you, and their religious beliefs might enter into the assignment, but they are otherwise answering the questions the way they should be and demonstrating the knowledge that the instructor wants them to demonstrate. But that's not what the bill says. It says, and shall not penalize, which I think then begs begs the question of, okay, how much of this insertion of religious belief into assignments is to be tolerated? Mm-hmm. What if it's entirely religious? Of course, I know your listeners and followers are well aware of such things as young Earth creationists that believe that the Earth and everything around it has only been in existence for several thousand years. And so if a student were to answer a question about the Big Bang or biological evolution or something like that, using their religious beliefs, again, how much of that exactly is tolerable, and what exactly can an instructor do about it? Because the bill tries to have it both ways. It says, grade these papers and these assignments the way you normally would, but don't penalize them based on the religious content. And if the idea is you want to have some sort of allowances for this, where, look, frankly, it might make sense, it might add to an overall understanding, it might make the papers or assignment better, in fact, they want to protect those situations. But again, that's not what the bill says. The bill says, and shall not penalize. And so at best, it's an open question as to what students are going to be doing here and how they're to be graded. And in our mind, it's just going to cause all kinds of confusion in a classroom should the bill pass with this language.
Hmm. What are the other major problems with this bill as passed by the Ohio House?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the far bigger problem, while it's the assignment and coursework language that has garnered the most attention, far more problematic from a church-state perspective in Ohio public schools, is the bill also has another provision that says students enrolled in public schools can engage in religious expression before, during, and after school hours, which we know, and generally speaking, I mean, it's not all bets are off, but generally speaking, that is true, and that's protecting their First Amendment rights with regard to religious liberty. But once again, the bill goes on to say, that this religious expression can be done in the same manner and to the same extent that a student is permitted to engage in secular activities or expression before, during, and after school hours. And that will cause all kinds of problems in schools. And the example I've been using, which I hope hits home with people, although I'm not entirely confident that it always does, is you have a student group devoted to suicide prevention. And they come up with some ideas and do some research and everything, and they want to present that to fellow students because they're worried about suicide prevention in their particular school. So they go to the principal and they say, look, principal, we would like to have a school assembly and use the school gymnasium to have a program on suicide prevention where we will present information about stress management, about mental health, about who to contact, and all of these other types of things. Completely secular, non-religious speech. Well, under House Bill 164, it says that religious expression and practices must be permitted in the same manner and to the same extent, which means that a student the next day could go to the principal and say, we want to have our own assembly about suicide prevention, and what we plan on saying is that the answer to suicide prevention is to get right with God or get right with religion, period. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it doesn't even have to be about suicide prevention. Maybe they just want to call their students together under the auspices of the school to have a prayer in the gymnasium during the school day or any other number of things, because when you're talking about language like in the same manner and to the same extent, you're opening up all kinds of doors. And we've seen very real situations across the country, for instance, where schools, I think some of them trying to act under what they think is fairness or just not caring about constitutional limitations, where, for instance, you'll have students talk about that day's or that week's activities over the public address system. And then you have students with religious beliefs saying, hey, why can't we use the public address system for these same reasons? And before you know it, it turns into prayers over the PA system. And these are issues, real issues. They've been litigated. They've gone up to the United States Supreme Court. And so our concern is that when you're opening the door that way, good luck closing it as a result. And this is particularly sensitive for schools because, you know, the Bill of Rights, of course, applies to the government. And public schools are the government. They are a government entity. And government must remain neutral with regard to religious belief and religious practices. They can't be seen as inhibiting them. They can't be seen as promoting them. And so schools oftentimes have to walk a fine line here with regard to this. But, you know, if you have a situation where if a student is going to speak in a non-religious way, have whether it's flyers or a pep assembly or any number of things that you can think of that's non-religious, under House Bill 164, again, they have to allow the specifically religious expression and speech in the same manner and to the same extent. And again, that's just going to cause all kinds of constitutional problems.
Yeah. Well, what kind of arguments have you heard in support of the bill? What purported problems does it solve, and what kinds of educational institutions would be under its jurisdiction?
Well, there have been a couple witnesses who have come in and testified regarding problems that they have had in individual schools in their own lives. And if what they're saying is accurate, at least the testimony that I have been there for in person, does sound like there were some problems. And in ACLU of Ohio here, we hear these same problems every once in a while. Most of the time, these get taken care of by contacting the school and explaining that they can't do this under the First Amendment, and they should. We call them knock-it-off letters here at the ACLU of Ohio. You don't have to, you know, rush to the courthouse and file a federal lawsuit over this stuff, when many times it can be taken care of short of doing that. And it sounds like in some instances these people have hired counsel and tried to do that and were unsuccessful. And so sometimes lawsuits do become necessary. But what they have found are these couple of instances where students or their parents are complaining about things that have happened in the past, which my understanding they were eventually resolved. A shame that people have to go to court regarding this. But again, they were resolved. But, you know, while these are things that do happen in Ohio, it's not like we have a tsunami of these situations happening every day across the state of Ohio. And, you know, at the ACLU of Ohio, we see nothing wrong, for instance, with providing extra instruction and guidance to students and schools and school districts about the religious rights of kids when they're in the public schools. We think, I mean, more education is never a bad thing with regard to these. But you don't need to do it with state legislation. It's just we don't see it as accomplishing very much. And at a more of a 30,000-foot view, the bill, of course, is not needed. Student religious liberties in public schools are protected by the First Amendment. They are protected by the Ohio Constitution. And, of course, the federal Constitution and the state Constitution supersede state law. So we've already got belt and suspenders, and I don't know what House Bill 164 exactly is, but it's unneeded for that reason, because we already have those protections, and those protections aren't going anywhere. And then on top of it, House Bill 164 also, in a sense, it kind of cuts and pastes terminology and legal principles from case law that's out there with regard to these types of issues when they reach court, and it inserts them into state law. And that is not helpful. We don't do this with any other area of the law or constitutional rights. This has all been purposely kept broad over the years. So, for instance, we have a right to free speech, according to the First Amendment. We have a right to free speech, period. But, of course, as we know, we don't have an unlimited right to free speech. You can't lie about people in the sense of, you know, slander or libel or defamation or anything like that. There's a variety of things, speech and expression, that you can't engage in legally. Not much, but there is some. But the point is it's not unlimited. And when these documents were originally drawn up, they were purposely kept broad so that future generations can decide how they're applicable to their own lives and their own societies. What they didn't do is say, let's take every little thing regarding free speech and say what's allowed and what's not. And I don't think the ACLU of Ohio doesn't think we should do that in state law, because, after all, what happens is this language changes. New court decisions come out changing things, changing the state of the law, changing the state of case law, and I can guarantee that the Ohio General Assembly is not going to go back to the drawing board and pass a new bill every time a court decision comes out that impacts the religious liberties of students in our public schools.
Yeah. Our listeners are familiar with Project Blitz, the nationwide conspiracy to write theocratic legislation for use by friendly state lawmakers. As I understand it, this initiative came from that bill mill. Is that correct?
You know, I don't know that. I mean, it could very well be true. I just simply don't know. I often get asked about how things are happening in other states and sort of the, you know, how it came about. And I often tell people, frankly, I've got my hands full trying to keep track of what's going on specifically in Ohio. But there is no doubt. I mean, I've talked to some other people about this. I've talked to someone in our national office who follows these types of things. And there's no doubt that this is part of a concentrated effort in state legislatures across the country to get bills of this type passed.
Yeah.
They're not all the same. When there's efforts like this, they rarely are the same. Some of them are more problematic. Some of them are less problematic. But again, I think it all goes back to they're entirely unnecessary. If we're worried about student religious liberties, we got the First Amendment, we have the Ohio Constitution, and if additional education needs done for administrators, for teachers, for students about religious liberties, then let's talk about that. I think that's something we can all agree on about, you know, when that's appropriate and how much of that is appropriate. But House Bill 164 does not do what supporters say it will do, and in fact it takes us places where schools are going to be confused, and they will inevitably, I think, engage in unconstitutional practices trying to comply with this bill if it passes into law.
Gary, you testified in front of a House committee in May in opposition to this student religious liberty bill. You've given us already a lot of information on your opposition to it and what you think about it. Is there anything else you want to say in terms of your opposition to this bill?
I think we have covered most everything. I will say this, though, that one of the frustrating things about this issue in the Establishment Clause and what that means for government and for society and everything is that, at least in the Ohio legislature, and I suspect this holds true in many places across the country, is there is very, very little knowledge about religious liberties and the Establishment Clause and what's permitted and what is not. And so does become hard to advocate and discuss issues such as these that require a fair amount of nuance and knowledge about these things, not to mention the ramifications and how this might affect individual students. So suffice to say, it's an uphill battle with much of this because you kind of have to bring a lot of legislators. You have to bring them along from the very start about what the Establishment Clause is, what it does, what it means, what the regulations are, the restrictions, the allowances, and all of that before you can ever get to a point of discussing what House Bill 164 does and what it does not do. Yeah. And I think that's a shame because we're all interested in what the role should be with regard to government and religion and protecting people's religious rights or lack of religion or what have you. But you know, we're all interested in how this all intersects with government. And again, it becomes difficult to discuss these things when there is a fundamental lack of knowledge collectively in the legislature.
I know the Ohio House has now passed the bill. What's the timeline for this bill heading to the Senate? And what do you think are the chances for the Ohio Student Religious Liberty Act becoming law?
Well, in Ohio, we have a two-year legislative session. We are about done with the first year of it, 2019. We'll also be around in 2020. Because it's a big election year, the anticipation is that legislators will be around less in 2020. 2020 than they were in 2019. It was just recently, I think yesterday, assigned to a Senate committee. So we shall see. I always hate to sort of predict what the legislature is going to do with these sorts of things. This is not the first time this bill has been before the General Assembly, or some version of this bill has been before the Ohio General Assembly. So, again, I spoke about that uphill battle of informing legislators about these things. And so now that it has passed one chamber and is heading over to the other chamber, I think it will be necessary for groups like the ACLU of Ohio to further engage legislators about our concerns with the bill. And again, what we see is the absolute lack of necessity to have a bill such as this. So, so you know, we'll be working on it now that it's in the Senate. But you know, will it ultimately pass, and what will it look like if it does pass? Because again, it can be amended over time. Maybe at a minimum, if they are intent on passing it, maybe what we could do is get some of this more problematic language and provisions removed or changed in the bill. And see exactly how that would work out.
Gary Daniels is chief lobbyist at the ACLU of Ohio. Our listeners can keep up with your important work at acluohio.org. Gary, thank you so much for briefing us on this bill, and thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I always appreciate having plenty of time to talk about these nuanced and complex issues, and I think we accomplished that here. And if people are interested in this particular bill in Ohio, as you said, ACLUOhio.org is our website. They can follow there regarding the progress and our work on the bill as time goes on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Rabbi Justin David of Hias, a nonprofit organization that has been helping refugees and displaced persons for 130 years. But first, you'll meet the author of a powerful new book, Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. On this show, we are fortunate to regularly feature leaders in moral movements for justice and equality. Driven by religious conviction, these leaders are shaping the discourse around what it means to be an engaged person of faith in a time such as this. At the same time, these messages are affirmed and given power by the communities that act on them. An invaluable book has just been released, Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. And the author, the Reverend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, welcome to State of Belief, Jonathan.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
You say the religious right taught America to misread the Bible. What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm talking about my own experience, as a matter of fact. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church in the 1980s, and while I didn't recognize it at the time, that was just the moment when some political operatives within the Republican Party were reaching out to folks like Jerry Falwell and other preachers that had national radio ministries to recruit them for a political effort that was really rooted in a backlash against the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement of the 1960s and 70s. They faced a real demographic challenge after the Voting Rights Act was passed and after the Immigration and Naturalization Act passed. There was a challenge of how to get white voters to vote together. And with a diminishing base for that, they built a movement to unite folks in the South and the suburbs and the Sun Belt, not around their racial identity, but around their religious identity. And I was growing up in a place where, you know, people weren't particularly politically minded, but we were increasingly told that to be Christian, we needed to be pro-life, and to be pro-life, we needed to be Republicans. And so we were recruited for a movement that was really about serving political power and the economic interests of corporations, but we were told that it had everything to do with our faith. Mm-hmm. And I've seen that harm black folks and poor folks and immigrants, but I also see that that's hurting communities like the one that raised me, as increasing corporate control of our government has really hollowed out many of the services and regulations that even protect places like that. So I've written this book to try to push back against that and really to try to highlight the stories of people who've been using faith toward very different ends in our country.
Jonathan, I feel like I need to tell you that I was in the Southern Baptist Convention along that same time, and I was working on the executive committee of the convention, and so I watched going from inside that body to external work, and it was always interesting to me that the people who were claiming most to be living by the Bible were leading other people away from the Bible. As you know, that strong interest on the Bible went away when the major focus turned on various kinds of policies.
Well, thanks for saying that. You know, one of the things that opened my eyes to it, I wrote a book before this one on the history of slaveholder religion in the 19th century. And when I was going through the archives, I found a letter from one of the chief advocates of slaveholding in the South, Robert Louis Dabney, a professor of theology at Richmond.
Right.
And he writes in the 1850s saying, "We have to drive the Bible argument continually and force the abolitionists back against the wall."
Yeah.
And I realized, oh, wait a second, that same kind of religion was really used in my youth to convince us that civil rights and women's rights and human rights were anti-Christian.
Yeah. We've seen Scripture quoted to condemn the civil rights movement, critics of Richard Nixon and many other instances. Overseas, authoritarian horrors were perpetrated with that kind of religious rhetoric. So what gives you hope that today's more progressive, faith-driven movements can have a real impact?
Yeah, so in addition to telling this history of how the religious right co-opted the Bible over the last 40 years, this book also chronicles the real stories of people who have been impacted by very bad policies, by voter suppression, by anti-immigrant policies, by the mass incarceration of the whole law and order era, and yet in the midst of that, read the scriptures as good news that God is for them and that God connects us across these issues to build a movement for change. And so it's being with those people and learning from them, largely over the last few years in today's Poor People's Campaign, what we call a national call for moral revival. When I was coming out of the religious right, because I'd kind of hit a dead end within it as a young person, I met the Reverend William Barber here in North Carolina, who began to teach me that there was another way of reading the Bible, and that people had read the Bible to be a call for justice and for work together across lines of division in the public square for the common good. And I became part of a movement that is doing that and that has all kinds of people in it, but that also looks back at U.S. history and says, you know, the only thing that has ever really pushed this country toward a more perfect union has been a kind of faith-rooted fusion coalition of people who realize that, you know, the Bible really is a book that was written by poor and marginalized people for poor and marginalized people. It's good news for the poor, as Jesus proclaims at Nazareth. And that, to me, is the hope that, you know, the God who raised Israel out of Egypt and raised Jesus from the dead can also raise us out of the mess that we're in today.
Hmm. I'd love to have you talk about some of the examples of effective action that you include in your book.
We got involved with building a poor people's campaign that would, you know, build on and raise up the witness from 50 years ago because of what happened here in North Carolina during Moral Mondays.
Yes.
When religious right organizations and the extreme right anti-government institutions and movements really converged here in the 2013 to take control of the state house and of the governor's office and began to really dismantle the government. And what happened was people from many different walks of life found that they were being impacted by that. You know, people who had kids in public school and were school teachers, people who were losing access to health care and to their federal unemployment insurance, people who had coal ash in their water and it was killing them. And across these issues, Reverend Barber really called people who had been working on specific issues together in a fusion movement and said, you know, that's a deep history in North Carolina, that's really what reconstructed North Carolina after the Civil War, that black and white folks came together and formed a coalition that, you know, was not only about making citizenship real for formerly enslaved people, but that also guaranteed public education to everyone in North Carolina for the first time. And that, for me, that was important because, you know, as a white man raised in North Carolina, I had never been told that I only got a public education because black folks and white folks worked together in the late 19th century to make that a guarantee for everyone in this state. And so being part of that movement really opened my eyes to the way that those who have struggled for justice from places of really being hard-pressed and against the wall have really made this country better for all of us. Mm. And I wanted to be part of that and certainly want to chronicle it with this book and share those stories with other people. I think we need that hope in these times.
Oh, we do. There's a lot of concern these days about how polarized we've become, how we only interact with people who think exactly like we think.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend mm-hmm. Barber has been on this show several times talking about the diversity of Americans, the Morrow Mondays movement that you've talked about. And he has helped you and me and many people to understand that we can do some things together that will be positive for all of us and make us a better country. Do you mm-hmm. sense that enough people recognize how critically important it is to not allow ourselves to be siloed apart from people with whom we disagree?
Well, those are certainly the people we're meeting in the Poor People's Campaign. We were just in eastern Kentucky, you know, where coal miners and former coal miner families were really organizing alongside black and Latino service workers because they recognized that the government in Kentucky wasn't really serving any of them. And they're building the Poor People's Campaign there. We've been there mostly to listen to them and learn from them and lift up their voices. But one of the things we saw in this election here last month was that when they did that kind of organizing, those counties in eastern Kentucky flipped. And they didn't support this religious right governor, Matt Bevin, who, you know, said he was representing life issues when, as a matter of fact, you know, people don't have living wages, people don't have health care, people are dying. And those people organized and put in a governor who, on the night he was elected, said, you know, in the language that they had been using, that some things aren't left or right, but some things are right or wrong. So, yeah, I see it happening. I see a new coalition of people coming together. And I think it can often feel overwhelming when we talk about these things in the terms that we've been given, you know, of red states and blue states, red counties and blue counties. There are places in this country where people really believe somehow that that they've turned so red that they can't be anything else. And what we've seen is that in those very places, when people organize around moral issues, you can engage people who've been disengaged. I think the thing that we often forget is that we had one candidate, the current president, who won 26% of the eligible voters in 2016, and another candidate, Hillary Clinton, who won 28%, but 40% of people didn't vote, mm-hmm. because those people who are actually a greater number than those who voted for either candidate, a lot of those people don't feel like the system is in any way serving them. Mm-hmm. We have 140 million poor people, poor and low-income people in this country. That's almost half the country. And a lot of those folks are disengaged, and yet when given hope that things really can change, that, you know, an agenda that lifts up their issues and that promises a better life for them, I really do think it's possible to see change, even and especially in the places where we think it's least likely.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's so important to stress that. You have written well about the whole idea of reclaiming public faith. People have to be, I think, much aware that the change that needs to happen is not going to happen just accidentally. We know that those who have benefited so greatly from hijacking religious language and credibility and power will mm-hmm. not give up without a fight.
That's right. But they also knew that they couldn't do it without faith, because
yes.
faith is so powerful. It matters so much to so many people. And that's why, you know, writing this book and going around talking to folks about it right now, I'm really trying to encourage pastors and faith leaders in their communities to engage folks on these moral issues. This isn't just about politics. This mm-hmm. is about loving our neighbor. And I know, you know, churches aren't PACs. You know, you don't need to get out there and endorse candidates or, you know, say, I mean, I don't think we need a religious left to address the religious right. I think we need to reclaim the moral center. Mm-hmm. And we need to say that a lot of these issues have just gotten all a kilter because so much money has been invested in shaping a narrative that really not only undermines our politics, but undermines our faith.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can say it's pro-family to support a policy that rips families apart and puts kids in cages, I think you begin to see that, you know, the language doesn't mean much. If you can say you're pro-life, but you're all for taking health care away from folks and cutting food stamps, I at some point, I think the language begins to fall apart, and we need a better narrative, and that's what this book is trying to do, to help people see that there's another way of reading the Bible, and we can learn that way of reading it from the people who've been reading it that way all along.
You've worked very closely with the Reverend William Barber, and I think it's important for our listeners to hear your thoughts about why, and you've already touched on this, but I want you to go further, why the campaigns that he has led and that you've been in have resonated so powerfully with so many diverse people of faith?
Well, I think what I've heard as we've been in places is that, frankly, a majority of people never bought the argument that the religious right was making. A minority just made it so loudly, and there wasn't a strong presentation of an alternative that dominated, and not just in the faith community, in the public square. You know, we ceded a lot of ground in letting folks say that, you know, abortion and human sexuality were the only moral issues, when, as a matter of fact, as Reverend Barber has said over and over again, at the heart of Scripture, concern for the poor, for the immigrant, and for the vulnerable women and children is the heart of the prophetic and the Jesus tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you begin to think about our engagement in public life around those issues that the prophets lift up, then you begin to see not only have we neglected that part of the scripture, but we've also neglected the very strong warnings in scripture about how faith can be misused by those in power. You know, Jesus says, "Woe unto you hypocrites! You've fulfilled your religious obligations, but neglected the weightier matters of the law, the love and justice that gets lived out when we practice love of neighbor, not only personally or as churches, but when we practice it through public policy." So I think Reverend Barber has been a powerful voice in articulating a tradition that he inherited and that many people share, frankly, but one that was marginalized by the very loud voices of the religious right for the past 40 years.
Yeah, and you have written a book that goes hand in hand with the kind of work that you're talking about. I'm curious, what do you hope everyone who reads your book will take away from reading it and move into initiatives that help them lay out in their own lives what you've written about?
Well, I hope it does two things for people. I hope it helps people who've been frustrated and confused to say, aha, I see how this happened, because I try to tell the story of how much money and how much organizational activism was involved in shaping the narrative of the religious right. But then I also hope that, you know, when people say, aha, I see that happen, that people can also say, wait a second, in the long story here, there's always been another way, and there are many people who are living that way, who are teaching us and showing us how to read the Bible in that way, and I can join and be part of that. I mean, the Poor People's Campaign has really been about uniting movements that have been at work along various issues, and there's some organization doing that work in absolutely every community in this country. So mm-hmm. I hope people will connect with that work, connect with the campaign, and rise up together, not just in 2020, but beyond, to really reshape the moral narrative in American public life.
I know there are many hurtful things that you and your congregation are experiencing right now, even. So I want to ask you a very personal question. How do you find hope at a time like this, and how do you encourage your congregants to walk forward in hope?
Yeah. Well, you know, I was just yesterday with Pastor Jose Chicas. I tell his story in the book. He has been in the United States since 1985. But when the Trump administration began, he had to take sanctuary at our church in order to avoid deportation and separation from his wife and kids and his congregation. He's a pastor, all of which is here in Raleigh, North Carolina. And so I was sitting with him yesterday, and we were talking about Advent, this season that we're in, and the hope of the season. And he said, I look at the people in Egypt and how they were crying out to God, and I remember God's promises, and I know that it was hard for them, and it's hard for me, but I'm going to hold on to God's promises. It's witnesses like that that really give me hope. There are people who faced a lot worse than I have, and who have learned in the midst of that what real faith is, and so I thank God for them. I, in many ways, feel like I've been converted to a faith that's real and that can sustain me in the face of trouble because I've known people like Pastor Jose. And in many ways, with this book, I wanted to not just introduce people to those voices, but also to their faith, to a faith that's deeply rooted in Scripture and that frankly brings Scripture to life. It certainly has for me.
The Reverend Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is Associate Minister at St. John's Missionary Baptist Church in Durham, North Carolina. A prolific writer, public speaker, and activist, Jonathan is the author of numerous books, including Reconstructing the Gospel, the Third Reconstruction, along with Reverend Dr. William Barber II, and then his becoming the answer to our prayers, among others. His latest book is titled Revolution of Values, Reclaiming Public Faith for the Common Good. Jonathan, this is a very timely book and an encouragement as well as a call to action. You've done it well. Thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you for you and what you're doing. May we all press on forward together.
Hias was founded 130 years ago as the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society and has saved untold thousands of lives in the decades since. TRUA, the Rabbinical Call for Human Rights, is an alliance of over 2,000 Jewish faith leaders working to protect and defend the most marginalized among us. Last month, a delegation of activists and faith leaders led by these two organizations traveled to our southern border to witness conditions and hear the stories of the desperate people trapped there by a broken immigration system and deliberately cruel policies. Rabbi Justin David was on that trip, and I am grateful to welcome him now to State of Belief Radio. Justin, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored to be here.
In early November, you joined other activist faith leaders on a journey to refugee camps at our nation's border. What were you able to see?
Well, we were actually able to see quite a bit. We were there for about, parts of about 4 days. And because we were a group of clergy, we were given access pretty readily to some sites that would be difficult for the general public to get to see. And because we were traveling with Hias in particular, they were able to give us a lot of the logistical support and facilitate the contact that probably individual groups or ad hoc organizations might not be able to get to. Yeah. So our first day after, a briefing, after an evening with a whole briefing of Hias on the asylum process, we went to a shelter set up in Juarez, obviously on the Mexican side, and established by the Mexican government, a shelter to house asylum seekers who were essentially waiting their turn to appear at the border so that they could have an initial hearing about their case to determine whether it had merit to go forward. And these seekers, the grand prize for getting through the border, of course, would be to go into ICE detention when they could have another hearing. And at this shelter, there were about 600, 700 people, many of whom had come from Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, and had migrated up through Central America and were being held here while they waited their turn for their case to be heard by Border Control, in most cases for up to about 6 months. Families were housed together. There was one, if you can imagine, sort of a giant warehouse that was cordoned off into different sections, the biggest central section being that which was occupied by, rows and rows of bunk beds. People are separated into men and women, and children could choose which parent they would want to sleep with. And that's where the people slept. Another section was reserved for children's activities and a kind of makeshift school during the day. Another section was reserved for kind of good swap and other things that the residents might need. And the kitchen was a mobile kitchen provided by the Mexican army, which was outside. Hmm. I have to say the most arresting aspect of being in that setting was the sight of children. Hmm. Now, here children, of course, were with their parents. This is, after all, on the Mexican side of the border. But there was this sense in which a number of children readily approached adults. They had a very strong connection with the gentleman who was leading us around the shelter. It was a a young man, was a very gentle, kind person. But we were 19, you know, 20 Jewish clergy and the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And these children who were 8 or 9 years old sort of came up to us, sidled up to us, engaged with us. And I couldn't help but think where these children had been and the traumas that they'd experienced. And I could only imagine what they were experiencing in that moment, in this place that on the one hand, you know, certainly felt to them temporary, that they knew was temporary, but was also perhaps the safest place they'd been over a period of months throughout their journey.
Justin, is there a profile of a typical refugee that you met there, or was the population just too diverse for that kind of generalization?
You know, there are a number of different kinds of populations who are represented in this migration through the border. And our government has specifically targeted people who speak Spanish. So in this shelter, the overwhelming majority of people spoke Spanish. But coming up through this border are Latin American indigenous people who don't necessarily speak Spanish. There are migrants from Africa who are coming up through the border, migrants from Brazil. Interestingly, who are allowed in because they don't speak Spanish. But keeping in mind that among the people who in the in the shelter, whom I'm imagining were mostly, if not all, Spanish-speaking, there's quite a bit of diversity because they come from different countries. Their reasons for migrating are going to be different. Some are fleeing gang violence. Some are fleeing the effects of global warming. Some are fleeing political violence, and so those conditions are going to make things diverse. I don't know the numbers on this, but it's safe to assume that there were people in the shelter who were LGBTQ, and especially since that the Trump administration has taken that category out of the exceptions for people there. It had been that people who were LGBTQ would be let in and not asked to wait on the Mexican side, but the Trump administration has put a halt to that. So it depends how you describe diversity. But yes, I think there are a number of ways in which you can say this population, while perhaps primarily Spanish-speaking, was certainly quite diverse in their experience and their profiles and their needs.
Could you share one or two stories that you heard on this trip or experienced on this trip, stories of people trapped in this broken system and what drove them to come there?
Well, actually, we didn't hear a lot of personal stories because there's a very important ethical consideration when traveling as a group, which is that we're not going there to be voyeurs. We're not going to solicit people's individual stories. Here we are, a group of Americans. It happened that we were all white. And to go to the shelter or to go to a detention center, it didn't feel appropriate for us to ask people to share their stories. It felt a little coercive and voyeuristic. And so we refrained from that. However, outside the shelter, there was a woman who wanted to tell her story. And, you know, I don't have all the details handy right now, but she was a woman who came on her own from Guatemala, where, you know, she fled because of gang violence. It was, you know, very unsafe for her family, and she trekked over months to Mexico at great risk to her and to her family. And, you know, each person has their individual story, and really one of the heartbreaking things about it is that as one hears stories, whether, you know, at the border or whether in our own communities, there are these common features that are part of each person's unique journey. And that is just so heartbreaking to know that, you know, every month, you know, there are tens of thousands of people presenting themselves with these stories of horrible desperation. But the people we saw are facing an infrastructure of dehumanization that's really designed to make them feel that maybe they can come into this country and maybe they have a shot. But really, what our, you know, the whole infrastructure and the whole process seems to be designed to inculcate a feeling that they're unwelcome here. They're welcome to try, but that the odds are long, mm-hmm. and really that they're welcome to settle any place but our country. Mm-hmm. Why else would you say to someone who's desperately poor, who's fleeing political violence, who's fleeing the effects of climate change, who has taken a perilous journey over months to get here, why else would we say to them, wait in Mexico for 6 months?
Yeah.
There is no other reason. And then when they get across the border, they're put in what's essentially a jail. It's civil detention, but it's run like a jail with the same kind of scrutiny, the same kind of abuse by guards, the same kind of mistrust of their personhood. That's in jail, run by the same companies that run our criminal jails. Why else would we do that but to convey to people who are desperate that we really don't want them here? And that, to me, is really the most heartbreaking aspect of it, because we could do better. We know we could do better. And what all the advocates told us is that while there's been a general sort of increased scrutiny at the border since 2001, since 9/11, it's really ramped up by several degrees noticeably over the past 3 years. And particularly this regime of having people wait on the Mexican side in shelters and, of course, separating children at the border is a unique feature of the past 6, 8, 12 months of Trump administration policies.
We live in an age when more people than ever are incredibly generous with opinions that are less informed than ever. What would you say to Americans who are hostile to anyone seeking refuge or asylum in our country?
I would encourage someone, and these are conversations I do have with people in my own community, people in my own family. I would encourage them to try a thought experiment, to take note of those voices in your head, to put them aside for a moment, and think of what it's like for a single person or a family to leave their ancestral home and why they would do that, and what it's like to do that with great reluctance, with great fear, and to willingly accept a whole series of traumas and sacrifices and perilous circumstances. And then I would ask them, if such a person were to come to your door, what would you feel moved as a human being to do for them? And then we can have a conversation, because really what this is a deeply humanitarian problem, and the way that we're dealing with it is through criminalization and law enforcement.
Yeah.
And those two realities are a complete mismatch. And what we're missing from our policies is a real humanitarian focus and a basic sense of basic decency and empathy. And that decency and empathy is something that we are all capable of. And I think when we take a moment to divest ourselves of the spin and the rhetoric and the handy phrases that we keep in our minds to organize this really vastly complex crisis, I think when we replace that with a simple human empathic response, that changes us, regardless of our own political inclinations.
Yeah. Last month, Hyas sued the Trump administration over the state and local refugee ban. What do our listeners need to know about that action?
Yeah, I wasn't so closely involved in that, but in 2017, with Trua, I participated with a group of 19 rabbis who, in February of 2017, we took a seat in the middle of Columbus Square outside of a Trump hotel and risked arrest and were arrested in protest of this ban on refugees. I think people have to understand that refugees also have been facing desperate circumstances, and that when they arrive here, they're people who've actually already been vetted by our country as people who can thrive here in the United States. And I'm very fortunate in my community in Springfield, Massachusetts, to have a Jewish Family Services office that's had a robust refugee resettlement program now for almost 20 years. And to go down there and to step into those offices and meet the people who came here as refugees and now are working to resettle refugees and are counselors and social workers and psychologists and sending their kids to college and is really to walk into a community of great hope and vibrancy. And so I think we have to remember that yes, refugees arrive here in a state of real desperation, but they also arrive here with great hope. And if we provide people with the opportunities to realize that hope, we add so much energy and optimism and great vibrancy to our communities and to our society.
We're in a celebration of a time of the year in which people are talking about giving. What would you suggest our listeners can do to make a positive contribution to those who have nothing and don't even know where they'll be allowed to go?
Yeah. What I would encourage people to do is learn about the organizations that are helping people. HIAS is one of them, and if you go to HIAS, you can see links to all their partner organizations, the Las Americas Center, Raices, all these organizations that are helping people who are refugees entering this country. And contrary to the idea that I'd rather do more than give a check, actually giving a check helps these organizations in two ways. One is that money funds staff positions that can actually help people directly. But in addition to that, every small gift of whatever it is, $10, $15, $18, $20, $50, $100, all these little gifts become leverage for bigger donors to contribute substantial amounts of money to hire more staff people and to do more for people who are in desperate situations. So there are an inordinate amount of things that people can do. But on this issue of refugees and asylum seekers at our border, learn about the organizations, give what you can, and know that giving to a good, reliable organization is going to generate more support and more infrastructure in the future.
Rabbi Justin David leads Congregation B'nai Israel in Northampton and traveled with many other faith leaders and activists to our nation's southern border early in November for a faithful look at what refugees and asylum seekers are experiencing in all of our names. Rabbi David, thank you so much for being with us today. You have touched us as well as informed us, and I know our listeners are better for hearing what you've said with your first-person witness. Thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and know you're welcome here anytime.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to speak to you today.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, you've helped keep this program on the air. Let me say a very sincere thank you to you. Now, if you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. And do you know someone who you think might benefit from hearing what you're hearing? Please commit to sharing State of Belief with just one person this week. Do it on social media or in person. It is incredibly helpful to know that we're reaching more and more people, especially at a time such as this. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be a part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.